that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that, that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Order now at Acura.com.
Thanks to you at home for joining me this hour. On August 2nd of 2007, this was the top story on the evening news.
Tonight, the tragedy in Minnesota, the initial disaster, and now the search for more victims and for clues to what happened. The children stranded on a school bus when the bridge gave way.
You are looking live at the scene of the disaster here in the Twin Cities, where the first word that something had gone wrong arrived here at the height of the rush hour, just after 6 o'clock last night. We now know it was a bridge collapse, a disaster that got the attention and quickly of the entire nation.
The I-35 West Bridge collapsed in Minneapolis. The tragedy claimed 13 lives on Wednesday, August 1st. And the very next day, the president came out and said this.
A terrible situation there in Minneapolis. We in the federal government must respond and respond robustly to help the people there not only recover, but to make sure that lifeline of activity, that the bridge gets rebuilt as quickly as possible.
We in the federal government must respond to make sure that bridge gets rebuilt as quickly as possible. And that was exactly the kind of response you would expect from a president after a national tragedy like a bridge collapse. The next day, Congress voted unanimously, 421-0, to allocate $250 million in federal money to repair that bridge. Now, it wasn't like August of 2007 was some kind of golden pre-partisan era. It was 2 months before a presidential election, and presidential primaries were well underway. But none of that had any effect on how either party decided to respond to this tragedy. Flash forward to this week. Another tragic and deadly bridge collapse in a major metropolitan area, this time in the city of Baltimore, when a Singaporean container ship bound for Sri Lanka crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Just like in 2007, the president came out quickly to say that the federal government should immediately allocate funds to repair that key transit pipeline. What might normally come next would be a straightforward, nonpartisan effort to approve that funding and get to rebuilding. But we don't live in that world anymore. For one of our major political parties, there is now no such thing as a tragedy that exists outside of partisanship. Immediately after the Key Bridge collapse in Baltimore, Republicans and conservative media started searching for something, anything, that they might use to blame the collapse on President Biden and the left. First, it was immigrants.
The ship involved in the collapse of the bridge is 948 feet long, called the Dolly, a Singaporean flagged container. But of course, you've been talking a lot about the potential for wrongdoing or potential for foul play given the wide open border.
It didn't take long for that wide open border theory to fall apart. The ship was part of the normal flow of commercial vessels in and out of the country. The crew, all based in India. In fact, the only immigrants involved in this crisis were the six victims who had been doing maintenance work on the bridge when it collapsed, the people who died. So then conservatives moved on to diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, or DEI. How did they do that, you might ask? Well, Baltimore is a majority black city. It has a black mayor, and the state is run by a black governor. America's transportation secretary is an openly gay man. Therefore, the bridge collapsed under the weight of diversity. I wish I was joking. A Utah Republican state legislator who is currently running for governor shared a social media post claiming that one of the commissioners of the Port of Baltimore, a black woman, knows nothing about ports, but she is a diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging auditor and consultant. A Florida Republican congressional candidate posted a video of the bridge collapse with the caption, DEI did this. And then there was the freak out about Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg.
Secretary Pete Buttigieg. He's young. He's gay. Why do I mention that? Because that's how he got the job.
No human being on earth believes that Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, got his job at DOT because he was the most talented person out there. The president appointed him because he checked a very important box.
The bottom line with Buttigieg is that he's worried too much about personal pronouns, worried too much about DEI policies.
This is the mainstream Republican Party now. It is not the fringe. The fringe of the Republican Party actually has its own cockamamie theory that the bridge collapse was orchestrated by the deep state, but we're not going to get into that. The Republican Party has lost its mind on the Baltimore bridge collapse, and it is more than just rhetoric. After the bridge collapse, President Biden made this promise.
It's my intention that federal government will pay for the entire cost of reconstructing that bridge, and I expect the Congress to support my effort.
But because it is President Biden, a Democrat, because it is Baltimore, a black city run by a black mayor in a state led by a black governor, because this involves brown people, Republicans seem to have little interest in repairing an essential part of our nation's infrastructure. Here was Congressman Dan Muser on the Fox Business Channel today.
Is Congress going to need to pony up more money, or is there enough money in the infrastructure package?
Yeah. Great to be with you, Maria. Yeah, it was kind of outrageous immediately for Biden to express in this tragedy the idea that he's going to use federal funds to pay for it in entirety.
Apparently, Republicans think it is outrageous to use federal money to pay for the Baltimore bridge collapse. Congresswoman Nancy Mace says the funds to fix this bridge should come from Biden's infrastructure bill, money that, by the way, has already been spent. Congressman Muser says the money should come from money allocated for electric vehicles, which, by the way, would not be nearly enough. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene says the government should instead be spending its time investigating whether the bridge collapse was an intentional attack. Congressman Chip Roy says any funds for fixing this bridge need to be offset with new spending cuts. Just to be clear, the price tag on fixing this bridge is estimated to be more than $2 billion. This is not a GoFundMe project. This is the kind of thing that needs federal dollars allocated by Congress, and not just because it's the right thing to do. For Republicans who would like to see this as just a Baltimore problem, just a black problem, just an urban problem, it is worth remembering here that this bridge affects a whole lot more than just Baltimore. More than 52 million tons of foreign cargo was shipped through that port last year. Nearly 140,000 jobs could be impacted by the bridge collapse. The shutdown caused by this thing could cost the American economy more than $2 million per day in wages. And the port where this bridge collapsed is the second largest U.S. export hub for American coal. Bloomberg reports that the collapse has already had a significant impact on one Pennsylvania coal company, which exports coal through that Baltimore port. That is the kind of thing you might think Pennsylvania Republicans like Congressman Dan Muser would be concerned about. You might think a party that claims to care deeply about the U.S. economy and American industry would care about the staggering toll of this collapse, but it does not. Republicans are showing the country once again that it's not really about the economy or American jobs or even simply fixing what's broken. It is about weaponizing tragedy and stoking culture wars. And above all, it is about sticking it to Joe Biden. Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott spoke with my colleague Joy Reid yesterday, and he was very clear about what he believes lies at the heart of the Republican resistance to doing what needs to be done here.
We know what they want to say, but they don't have the courage to say the N-word. And the fact that I don't believe in their untruthful and wrong ideology, and I am very proud of my heritage and who I am and where I come from, scares them.
Joining me now is Charles Coleman, civil rights attorney and a writer for Slate. Also with me is former Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill. Charles, I have a hard time looking at what happened in 2007 when a Minnesota bridge collapsed and not comparing that to what's happening in the year 2024 when a bridge in Baltimore collapsed. Do you see a parallel here? And what do you make of the different reactions?
Of course. And I think that it's important to understand the continuum of how we got here. So we have slowly but surely allow these false equivalencies to come into our national dialogue and our conversation around politics such that, oh, go woke, go broke, the culture wars, all of these things have been a steady pushback, and they have gotten us to this place because we've allowed it. Mm-hmm. And we haven't called it out in the interest of trying to be fair, in the interest of trying to include all voices. The reality, Alex, is that there are some voices at this table who are speaking who do not deserve to be heard. And that's because what they are talking about is not ideology. What they are talking about is something that denigrates people's humanity. What they are talking about is something that keeps the two-tiered system of what America is in place and that structure undamaged. And that's why we have gotten to this place where somebody is saying, hey, we need to help these people. Mm-hmm. And you have people more concerned with profiting about going against Joe Biden.
Yeah. Well, and also making it owning the libs by saying right. It's an issue of DEI, right?
Right.
Claire, does it surprise you when you see what's sort of become of the Republican Party on an issue? I mean, I had to bring up American coal because it's like if Republicans needed any more reminder that this isn't just about doing the right thing, this isn't about Baltimore, this is about the essential part of the American economy and American energy that they're obsessed with, coal, and yet they still can't bring themselves to sort of understand why, you know, funding this is important.
Yeah, it's a knee-jerk reaction with them. If it is a blue state, a blue city, if it is a diverse community, if Joe Biden says it, then it's all bad. It's all bad. Now, here's what's going to get interesting, Alex. Let me say two words. Larry Hogan. Mm. Mm. For the Republicans to take the Senate, Larry Hogan is very important in that drive they have. They see Larry Hogan as an essential ace in the hole in terms of taking control of the Senate. Larry Hogan was the governor of Maryland just a few months ago. Larry Hogan is running for the Senate as a Republican. Now, how is he going to win if the Republicans are standing unified against helping the people of Baltimore, this incredibly important port for America's economy? So I'm going to watch the Republicans in the Senate because I guarantee you they are very nervous tonight about what this is going to do to Larry Hogan's chances to get elected to the United States Senate.
Can I follow up with you on that, Claire? Because I understand that as a matter of political strategy, but like House Republicans, who are the first line of action on this, don't seem to care about anything other than grievance and rage. I mean, it takes calculation. It takes like Mitch McConnell, the guy who's retiring, to say, wait a second. In the best interest of our party, which is to say taking the Senate in 2024, we got to do this. But I mean, does reason work anymore?
Well, I mean, who controls the Senate is who controls who goes on the bench. And you would think that a heart-to-heart discussion with some of the crazies in the House, I think they can get enough votes. I think, you know, there's going to be the crazy caucus. But if you combine the Congress folks from districts that Biden won, along with Democratic people in Congress, in the House, I think you can get enough votes to get emergency appropriations through. And remember, if you are against an emergency appropriation today, then what happens to your state when your farmers are suffering a drought? Or what happens when there is a horrific tornado? Or, I mean, everybody has the potential of having an emergency disaster in their state. And if we're going to go down that road, they're really playing with an issue that could really come back and bite them in the you-know-what hard.
Well, I mean, you sort of get a sense that that's happening already, right? Pennsylvania coal is getting shipped through Baltimore. You don't fix this thing, you don't get your Pennsylvania coal out. And there are Pennsylvania Republicans who are like, should we really fund this? Can't you just use funding for EVs? I mean, it gets to this narrative, Charles, where Republicans seem blind to the fact that we live in an interconnected country.
Right.
Like, we are a union. As much as they would like to believe otherwise, no man is a state unto himself.
You're right. But the one important caveat here, and it is a very significant one, is that we've been into a space where facts no longer matter, or at least they don't matter as much. And so when you're talking about the control of information, when you're talking about the wide and vast amount of misinformation that is poisoning our dialogue, it's easier for Republicans to make this clearer in terms of their perspective, if you want to call it that, than what's actually going on. And so there are a lot of voters who are not necessarily processing it in the ways that you just talked about, because they have monetized in terms of fundraising, in terms of votes, owning the libs. They've monetized, we're going against Joe Biden and Democrats with everything that they
well,
do.
Well, they see Wes Moore.
Right.
Who is a leading light of the Democratic
Correct.
Party, black governor of Maryland, and they see an enemy.
Right.
I mean, not just in a partisan sense, but in a social sense.
Oh, absolutely in a social sense. Let's not see, and this is exactly the conversation that needs to be had. I am not here to say or to suggest that every Republican is racist or has racist tendencies. But what I am here to say is that there is more of that than we give credit for, and we have not called it out in the ways that we need to, and that is a big part of how we've gotten here.
Claire, how does the Biden administration play this? Because I do think the sort of racist underpinnings of this are pretty obvious. The craven political calculation is like right on the surface. And yet, for the thing to actually get fixed, for the Biden administration to get the federal funding, they got to have Republicans play ball here. So how much can you really call them out on what they're doing in a moment of sort of, you know, political strategy?
Well, I think it will happen. I think the appropriators will take the reins here. And both Republican and Democratic appropriators know that emergency funding. I mean, I remember when that bridge collapsed in Minnesota. I remember how quickly we moved. I remember that it was anything but controversial. I mean, it was just like, of course we're going to do this. Same thing with the hurricanes, and Katrina and the hurricanes in New Jersey. These were things that we did. And I think there's enough people in Congress that this funding will get through. I'm not saying it's going to go quickly. I'm not going to say it'll go easily. But I think right now the House is barely holding on to a majority, Alex. I mean, they have a one vote majority. That's not a position of power or strength in an appropriations fight over emergency funding to one of the most important ports for exports in the United States of America. I think cooler heads will prevail.
I just am reminded, Charles, of Tommy Tuberville holding up all the military appointments to make a stand on abortion that was used 12 times total during a 7-month protest when he held the American military hostage. They will stop at nothing to further partisan gains. For talking points that they can use back home, they'll hold the military hostage.
This has become so polarized, it's embarrassing. And I think that we as an electorate have to be honest about that. And when you're talking about every member of Congress who's up for re-election this year, that needs to be in the forefront of voters' minds, because this level of polarization is not sustainable.
Yeah.
And so for as much as people want to talk about the preservation of democracy, beyond who's in the White House, this cannot continue, and it needs to be addressed.
We can't have an economy if we can't ship goods in and out of the country, and
exactly.
We're hemorrhaging $2 million a day in wages. Charles Coleman, Claire McCaskill, thank you both for your time tonight. Really appreciate it. We have a lot to get to this evening. Donald Trump is suddenly worth a whole lot of money on paper. Can he spend it before the bubble bursts? Plus, President Biden brings in the heavy hitters for a big fundraiser tonight, and I'm not talking about Will Arnett and Jason Bateman. That's next.
Ross has all the spring deals you want, so you can say yes to more looks for you and your budget. Tube tops for less? Yes. Dad shorts for the weekend? Yes. Mini skirts for less than online? That's a yes for you and your bank account. Find your certified yes for me moment and save 20 to 60% off department store prices every day at Ross. Hurry in for spring deals today. Items and styles vary by store.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Tonight, I can offer you a tale of two campaigns. On one side, President Joe Biden, who tonight, just a few feet from this very studio, is hosting a big deal fundraiser at Radio City Music Hall with former presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. Earlier today, the trio recorded an episode of Smartless, the podcast hosted by Sean Hayes, Will Arnett, and, what appears to be an inexplicably underdressed Jason Bateman. Now, Biden's event this evening is slated to raise more than $25 million, and his campaign is characterizing that as the most successful political fundraiser in American history. And that is adding to what is already a pretty colossal war chest for Biden and the DNC. Meanwhile, on the other side, the Trump campaign is spending the night comparing Trump stats to Biden's, something they love to do. Trump donors are trying to step on Biden's big night by saying a fundraiser they are holding next month will do even better. Joining me now is Mark Leibovich, staff writer at The Atlantic. Mark, we don't have to talk about Jason Bateman, and we'll get to Trump's money in a moment. But I want to get your sort of sense of this moment the Democratic Party is in. I will note, and we're going to talk about this in a second, there are protesters protesting the Biden policy in Gaza that are lining the streets. There have been several interruptions in the evening thus far. But $25 million, three presidents on stage, a number of, you know, a lot of star power as well. Does this feel like an inflection point for what has thus far been a kind of draggy gray story for Biden and his approval numbers and polling heading into an election?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't understate the importance of $25 million or Biden's fundraising advantage. I mean, you'd think that, you know, they could take some of that $25 million and buy Justin Bateman a jacket or something like that. But ultimately, yeah, I mean, it's obviously their fundraising advantage is very important, and this helps it immensely. I do think that the optics here are, you know, not great for Democrats, frankly. I mean, I do think it does feed into the blue state kind of entertainment-based elite. It also feeds into kind of a yesterday vibe that I think has dogged Biden a little bit, both because of his age, but also, you know, look, Clinton, Obama are yesterday presidents. And it's obviously customary to have elder states people campaigning for the person who's running. But, you know, you can't go too far with that. And especially, you know, when you have Stephen Colbert and Mindy Kaling around, I mean, that's not going to win you many swing voters in the Midwest. The other thing, yeah, I you mentioned the protests around there. I mean, this is something Biden and a lot of Democrats are getting everywhere. It does create a sense of chaos, especially when you have Trump, disingenuously or not, running, you know, to trying to grandstand on law and order. Today he was in Long Island to honor a fallen police officer. And yeah, I mean, we'll see what Trump raises. But as far as, you know, the Democrats sort of, you know, fixing their problem to sort of reach across their elitist kind of boundary at this point, this could be problematic. And I wouldn't sort of see it as a turning point in the campaign or message or anything like
well,
that.
Well, okay, fair enough. But I do wonder, I mean, setting aside, I would be hesitant to suggest that the Biden campaign thought this was going to win them any swing votes. To right, me, right. It seemed more like an event to inject some enthusiasm into a Democratic Party, especially young Democrats, who have thus far been kind of unexcited about the prospect on offer. And I'm not, like, I'll set Bill Clinton in his own category, but just sure, bringing yeah. Barack Obama back, reminding yeah. the country of, you know, those years, the president, they, you know, presidents become even more likable in the years after they leave the presidency. Do you think that is, it sounds like you think that that's not an effective tool to sort of, I don't know, change the amount of, or increase the amount of enthusiasm among the electorate?
I think ultimately, I mean, the Democrats these days look like a party of grown-ups, which is not a bad thing, given how nervous a lot of people are and given the contrast that Trump provided. So, I mean, I think that's extremely important. Ultimately, this is a big money event. And look, I think if you're serious about this, the Biden administration is a very serious administration. I think it's had some really solid accomplishments that they need to sell and sell really hard. And I think having the cavalry out in full force both tonight and going forward is extremely important. But, you know, ultimately, I mean, the youth vote and also the swing vote is not obviously centered in Radio City Music Hall. I mean, this is kind of where the Democratic core is as far as fundraising. And yeah, I think on the heels of the State of the Union and the recent sort of polling uptick we've seen and some of the other news, it's actually a good thing. And it sort of keeps going, and it keeps the momentum going that the Biden campaign, I think, has seen in recent weeks.
Yeah, there's a new ad comparing Biden's cross-country swing visits to Trump's golf right. swing. Maybe we can play a little bit of it for our audience.
Yeah.
With the president visiting 8 swing states in just 18 days, throughout the month, Biden has crisscrossed the country. Visiting the Southwest, the Blue Wall of the South. campaign stops have focused on border security, reproductive rights, lowering health care and housing costs, as well as celebrating CHIPS and Science Act investments.
This is kind of an interesting table flipping, right? Because for so long, it was like, oh, Biden in the basement. Biden doesn't do anything. He's weak. He's addled. He trips over everything. Now they're trying to position. They're trying to invert it and put the narrative on Trump that he's just an old retiree in Florida golfing a lot. Do you think it works?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think these ads have been pretty effective. I mean, first of all, credit to whoever did the little jingle or the music. I found myself bobbing my head along to this. But they're very effective. They seem to be circulating a lot, and they do seem to be sort of in keeping with a lot of the clownish stuff that, Trump does, like, you know, the $60 Bible thing and, you know, his basically, his daily stuff and that he provides, not to mention what the Congress is doing. So, yeah, I think that's been really good. And I think that, you know, in some ways, the campaign has found a voice and kind of a vigor that wasn't there before, both the candidate himself and certainly the ad makers.
I do. I have to say that Axios was reporting that the Republicans' top state level fundraising committee is privately warning against Biden bashing because it doesn't hurt down ballot candidates as much as, oh, Trump bashing has hurt the rest of the Republican Party. What do you make of that? Why do you think
that is? A little late to get that memo, you would say, right? I mean, stop Biden bashing, by the way. I mean, look, I mean, I think Biden was an imperfect target for them to begin with. I mean, he is a known entity. He is a likable entity, you know, and yes, you can drive his negatives down. But ultimately, I mean, you're not going to convince Joe Biden that he's the monster that some people on the far right of the Republican Party are so convinced that he is. It is an odd thing. I mean, I think it's true. I think down ballot, he doesn't have the reach that Trump certainly does in the Democratic Party. So, it does seem like kind of a weird and kind of almost herky-jerky pivot at a very inopportune time.
Yeah, the Republicans, weird, herky-jerky, inopportune.
Weird,
I can't
imagine.
Mark Leibovich with The Atlantic, thank you for your time, my friend.
Thanks, Alex.
Still to come tonight, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's pick to fill one of his coveted clerkships is raising eyebrows. We're going to get into that controversy just ahead. But first, Donald Trump's wealth on paper skyrocketed this week. Where the money comes from, whether or not it will last, and whether he can spend it is coming up next.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
As President Biden's reelection campaign projects a $25 million windfall at his Radio City fundraiser tonight, Donald Trump's personal net worth has ballooned over this past week, at least on paper. That is courtesy of his social media company, Trump Media and Technology Group, which went public on Monday. On its first day of trading, the company rocketed to an $8 billion valuation, making it worth more than the New York Times and Mattel and Western Union. Trump himself owns about 60% of that company. At this point in the story, you might find yourself wondering, how did we get here? After all, Trump Media and Technology Group's main product, Truth Social, has just 2% of the monthly active users of Twitter or Pinterest and an even tinier fraction of the monthly users of Meta. And also, last year, Truth Social lost almost $50 million against just $3 million in revenue. So how is Donald Trump able to take Truth Social from losing tens of millions of dollars last year to being worth $8 billion this year? And how long Can that last before the bubble bursts? And can Donald Trump use any of this money to pay off the $175 million bond he still owes in his New York fraud case next week? Joining me now, Matt Goldstein, business reporter from The New York Times. He's written extensively on this topic for The Times, so he is exactly the person to ask about this complex story. Matt, thanks for joining me tonight.
Thanks for having me.
You know the sort of nature of this company better than most. Can you explain to people who don't know, where is the money coming from? Who is investing in this company right now?
Well, you know, right now, most of the investors are individual shareholders. There are retail investors. There are about 400,000 or so when the merger took place. And the lion's share of them are actually Trump supporters. And they're not necessarily political supporters in the sense of like big donators. They're basically regular people who are true believers, and not only in Trump, but really in Truth Social. And I've talked to a number of them over the past few years, and it's almost like become like a religious kind of thing that they really want this company to survive. And they view themselves as getting in on the ground floor.
Do you think, Matt, that they have any sort of comprehension of the potential financial peril that could be involved here? I mean, I noted in your reporting in The Times that some of the big investors here have shorted, which is to say bet against Trump media shares, on the assumption that the company can't continue trading at this insane valuation. Trump media, according to S3 Partners, which is an outside financial data company, is now the most shorted company to merge with the SPAC. We won't get into a SPAC at this juncture, but it's one of the most shorted companies in the United States. That seems like a, what shall we call it, a big red flag.
It is. And, you know, and if you talk to his core base of shareholders, which would also be some of his core base of support, they're fully cognizant of that they could lose all their money. And I talked to one the other day, I think he's quoted in one of our stories, that he's willing to lose the money on the principle of trying to make this company grow. I mean, you bring up the SPAC. I mean, one thing to understand that the merger partner was this shell company that was out there for about 3 years before this deal closed. And a lot of them were in the red for the longest time because back when this deal was first announced, the stock surged to $90 and then it was hovering around 15 or 20 for much of the last 2.5 years. So some of them are in the black, some in the red, but I think it's almost a matter of principle for them. You know, obviously, I don't think anyone wants to lose all their money, but they see it as something bigger than just an investment.
How much of this can Trump tap into, right? I mean, he's frozen. He can't sell his shares for 6 months. He could ask the board permission to do so, but that would be akin to sort of like saying, I mean, it would be a real loss of confidence, right, for him to pull out at this stage.
I don't think that will happen. I mean, there's a reason why these restrictions are in place normally, and it's not uncommon for any company when it first becomes public. You don't want the majority shareholders to be dumping all their stock right away. It's not a good sign of faith. And I can tell you, the investors I've talked to, they don't think Trump will do that. And actually, they don't want him to do that. The more likely scenario is they could ease this restriction that he can't borrow against the stock, i.e. use it as collateral to get a loan or to post it for a bond that he might need to pay off, you know, the civil penalty. I think that's a more likely scenario that could happen. We haven't seen it yet, but it's only the first week of existence. It's a very Trump-friendly board. He's no longer chairman of the company, but the seven board members, five of them are clear loyalists. We have Devin Nunes, the CEO, former congressman, Don Jr., his eldest son, and three former Trump administration people on the board.
Do you feel like the value of this stock is going to track Trump's candidacy, which is to say, as the polling goes up or down, do you think that that could be reflected in the stock price?
Yeah, I think it's sort of a barometer or a proxy for Trump's, you know, fortunes. I mean, again, we're not going to say much about the stock, but the company before that it merged with, its stock really took off early this year when DeSantis dropped out of the New Hampshire primary. I mean, the stock began to soar. And before the merger, the stock had been up about 140% this year alone. I actually personally think there's a good chance the stock will continue roughly around these levels, at least through the election. As long as the election appears to be close, which every indication it's going to be, I don't really see an event taking place that's going to cause the stock the crater. But then again, when you're having a stock that's so overvalued, any unforeseen event can cause that. We just may not know what it is at this time.
Yeah. If we can say anything about Donald Trump, it's a volatile candidacy and a volatile stock. Matt Goldstein with the New York Times. It's great to have you on the program. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Still ahead this evening, you have heard of the term Nepo baby. But have you heard of the nearly adopted Nepo baby? Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has. We're going to bring you the latest ethics scandal centering on Justice Thomas. That is next. Having a billionaire benefactor comes with excellent perks, as might be expected. Justice Clarence Thomas, for example, has received multiple luxury trips and sweet real estate deals courtesy of his conservative patron, mega donor Harlan Crow. But as it turns out, Justice Clarence Thomas is also quite generous himself. His newest law clerk, Crystal Clanton, is not just his employee, she is practically his family. The New York Times reports that Justice Thomas and his wife Ginny took Miss Clanton in under their own roof when she was fired from the conservative group Turning Point USA after reportedly sending racist text messages. The couple began calling Clanton their nearly adopted daughter. Clanton was so close to the Thomases that she's prominently featured in some of the Thomases' recent Christmas newsletters, right alongside the Thomases' dogs, Petey and Rex. In addition to providing her housing, Clanton worked for Ginny Thomas, herself a conservative activist, at Mrs. Thomas's political consulting firm. And Justice Thomas has used his contacts to help Miss Clanton land a clerkship in his own office. Now, there is nothing illegal about keeping things close. But this is the Supreme Court, an institution that is encouraged by the non-binding federal code of conduct to avoid unnecessary appointments, nepotism, and favoritism. It is an institution that has a 60% disapproval rating right now. It is also an institution that is currently facing a giant credibility problem amid a flood of ethics scandals centering on Justice Clarence Thomas. So you might expect, I don't know, a bit more self-awareness, the sort of self-awareness the court exhibited when Justice Elena Kagan hired Merrick Garland's daughter to be her clerk in July of 2020. That was before her father was the head of the Justice Department. The Supreme Court then announced that Garland's daughter would not serve in that position as Elena Kagan's clerk while her father remained attorney general. By contrast, Justice Thomas has insisted on hiring his near daughter, the one on his Christmas cards. And man, does that sound like a very nice thing for him to do for her. The New York Times give us some idea of what Crystal Clanton's future holds. At least 18 of Thomas's former clerks have served as state, federal, or military judges, nearly three quarters of them appointed by Mr. Trump to federal courts, where they have ruled on issues like voting rights and access to the abortion pill. Many of Thomas's clerks have gone on to do Justice Thomas's bidding, and that seems like not that much of a coincidence.
Law clerks are law clerks. They are wonderful to have around. My view is that it's one of the best parts of the job. They have four energetic people who are like family. I mean, I select them. They're mine. They're my kids. They know how I think.
I'll talk about Justice Thomas's significant contributions to nepotism in the American judiciary with Mark Joseph Stern. That's next. Four years before he was appointed to the highest court in the land, Clarence Thomas said this: "There is nothing you can do to get past black skin. I don't care how educated you are, how good you are at what you do, you'll never have the same contacts or opportunities. You'll never be seen as equal to whites." Despite that perspective, Clarence Thomas has dedicated his time on the bench to undoing landmark civil rights achievements for black Americans. In 1995, he became the first Supreme Court justice to openly criticize Brown v. Board of Education, which, of course, outlawed segregation. In 2013, he voted to gut the Voting Rights Act. In 2023, he joined a decision to strike down race-based affirmative action. Thomas has also used his position to fill the judiciary with scores of his former clerks, most of whom are white, and all of whom, he says, share his views.
I'm not going to hire clerks who have profound disagreements with me. That's a waste of my time. And someone said that's like trying to train a pig. It's a waste of your time and aggravates the pig. So.
This week, we have some news that Thomas has decided to hire as his new clerk a woman who was publicly accused of sending racist text messages like the one that reads, "I hate black people," in capital letters. She is also someone Justice Thomas has described as nearly an adopted daughter. Joining me now is Mark Joseph Stern, senior writer covering the courts and the law for Slate Magazine. Mark, it's great to see you. I don't know where to begin with the racist text messages or the nepotism. Let's start just because there's a lot to talk about in the nepotism category. How unusual is it to hire a Supreme Court law clerk who once lived with you?
It is extraordinarily unusual, essentially unheard of since the olden days when the justices lived at boarding houses in 1800s Washington. This is new territory, and I think it really shows just how enmeshed Clarence Thomas and Ginny Thomas are with their professional networks. Crystal Clanton came to the Thomases as an assistant to Ginny Thomas after she was pushed out of Turning Point USA for being too racist, and then grew into not only a confidant to Ginny, but also a friend and nearly adopted daughter to Clarence. Now he's elevating her to a clerkship, which positions her well for first a $500,000 bonus if she enters private practice, and about 10 years down the line, a judgeship under a future Republican president. So the stakes are very high, and in part because of that, justices usually go out of their way to hire based on merit to ensure that they are not just picking their friends and family. Obviously, Clarence Thomas does things differently. Clanton may be the most extreme example of that, but she's not the only example.
Well, and you're right. It's important to point out what these clerks then go on to do, because, in the immediate, it doesn't seem like a good idea to have a law clerk at the Supreme Court who's texted, "I hate black people," just for what that does to the court itself, which is suffering from a major PR crisis at best. But on the second, people who write text messages saying, "I hate black people," shouldn't be in the pipeline that is clearly in existence as it concerns these law clerks. And Thomas really has seemed to have a profoundly efficient, he's built a very efficient pipeline insofar as his clerks really do have gone on in large number to become judges, to be an essential part of the American justice system. Can you talk a little bit more about his record on that?
Yeah, so Clarence Thomas's clerkships are unique in that they sort of function as an indoctrination boot camp. And as that clip you showed earlier indicates, he doesn't hide this. He goes out of his way to select clerks who already agree with him. He actually has direct lines to conservative professors at law schools like Notre Dame who pick the most ideologically extreme and pure students and put them in the pipeline up to a future clerkship. Once they're there with Clarence Thomas, he instills in them this extreme far-right conservative philosophy, sends them on their way. Many of them do take these payouts in private practice. The bonus for a Supreme Court clerk right now is about $500,000 for your first year. But then they find their way back into public service, quite frequently in the form of a judgeship. Donald Trump and his advisors went back time and again to Clarence Thomas's former clerks to pick judges, and they have consistently proved to be some of the most extreme on the bench. Judges like James Ho in the Fifth Circuit, who wrote a decision arguing that the courts should abolish access to the abortion pill in all 50 states. Judges like Alison Jones Rushing, who just today upheld an extreme racial gerrymander in the state of North Carolina. These judges have a mission that Clarence Thomas helps them to refine. And once they are out in the world, they work very hard and very consistently to achieve those goals and circle back around every year for a meeting with Clarence Thomas and his clerk family, where they all congratulate each other on all that they've done to further the cause.
Mark, it's South Carolina where that extreme racial gerrymander is happening, right? Just
yes,
want to be clear. Okay. And it's not just judgeships that these clerks go on to. John Eastman is a former Clarence Thomas law clerk. Is that right?
Yes, John Eastman, who's currently being disbarred from California because of his participation in trying to overturn the election. One of the more extreme examples, but a very good one. Another one is John Yoo, who wrote the torture memos under George W. Bush. Laura Ingraham, a hate monger on Fox News every night. Not all of these individuals go directly into the judiciary. They might work on trying to overturn free and fair elections or whipping up hatred against Muslim and immigrants. But either way, they are preaching from the gospel that Clarence Thomas helped to write. And I am sure that Crystal Clanton will be set along the exact same path once she graduates from this boot camp.
This is Clarence Thomas's army, ladies and gentlemen. Mark Joseph Stern, it is always so great to talk with you, Mark. Thanks for making the time tonight.
Thank you.
That is our show for this evening.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.